Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on AirsLA and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 332 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show designed and developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scenes, recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts, memoirs and commentaries from gardeners and designers alike, and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I have spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design tradition, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I have been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens across the country and around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and have been charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, space, light, and shade. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And, as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. We start this week with an article by Claire Colson that was published on February 21st in the Financial Times of London, Lessons from a Flower Farmer. Listen to what you like and then fill your life with it. After a decade shaping her cottage garden, Millie Proust is starting over and has sage advice for gardeners starting from scratch. Millie Proust is standing in the expansive walled garden of her new home, a Grade II listed farmhouse set in 58 acres on West Sussex's South Downs. There are characterful, gnarly trees, and an ancient wisteria winds its way across the front of the house, but mostly it's a vast, bare and very muddy blank canvas. I have a strong sense of what I want to do and how I want it to feel, says the floral designer and flower farmer, who moved here a few months ago with her husband Ted Duane, bassist for the band Mumford & Sons, and their three-year-old son Rex. But I'm going to allow it to unfold and not jump ahead. For now, beyond the stone walls, there are mounds of builder's bags, big machinery, and tradesmen at every turn. After years of cramming her previous garden with cutting beds and maximizing every square inch with flowers, she finally has space. There are two large polytunnels for growing and a one-acre flower field. The house now links via glass walkways to an oak-framed barn, an HQ for the seed and floral design company she founded in 2018 and now runs with her business partner, Paris Alma. But perhaps most exciting, for now at least, is the walled garden and the potential of a fresh start. Making a garden from scratch is also the subject of her latest book, How Does Your Garden Grow? Quadrille Publishing, 22 pounds, which covers planning, designing, planting, and maintaining a space, and is illustrated with pictures of her first garden just 20 minutes away from her new home. In 2017, she had arrived at a 17th-century timbered cottage surrounded by ancient woodland as an absolute beginner. She had only grown in pots and window boxes in London flat chairs. She then spent almost a decade creating a cottage garden with tonal borders, beds, and cutting patches. It was all resolutely lo-fi and low-budget, but through it, she learned to be a gardener and grower. I became obsessed I read so many books. Eric Ben Zakin's Cut Flower Garden and Sarah Raven's The Cutting Garden remain her go-tos. I tried lots of different techniques and tactics and found what works. She made a pale night garden where a succession of narcissus and hellebores was followed by pale wallflowers, tulips, foxgloves, roses, gentle Hermione and Desdemona, and campanulas, jasmine and phlox. An old veg patch became a cut flower patch, enclosed by handmade coppiced hazel fencing and arches, and long flower beds were filled with peonies underplanted with scented geraniums, alchemilla molas, and bulbs. Proust originally trained as an actor, a profession where, she says, you're met with failure pretty much every day. But as a gardener, she has embraced it, figuring out what doesn't work and figuring out what does work and then writing that down. As a flower farmer, the learning curve is fast and steep. Failures are costly. What can gardeners learn from a flower farmer? A great deal. In her book, Proust breaks down her approach to color, which is dominated by subtle tonal shifts and tints. She grew up in London, surrounded by art. Her mother was an artist, and Saturdays were often spent trailing around the Courtauld Gallery. At home, color was something we talked about a lot, said Proust. If someone isn't confident with color, they need to tap into how colors make them feel. Don't worry about what's trendy, just listen to what you like, then fill your life with it. One of her most frequently asked questions is around succession and ensuring that there's always something of interest in flower. She says it can be achieved in the most low-maintenance way by underplanting trees. In her first garden, a mini-orchard was underplanted with snowdrops, crocus, narcissi, iris reticulata, and species tulips, which were followed by camassias, martagon lilies, and Dutch iris. Everything naturalizes and expands year on year on its own. And you've got these incredible, biodiverse, beautiful space that means minimal maintenance. Starting over in her new house has brought some new challenges. I've never really done hard landscaping before. It was always just me with a wheelbarrow making paths and being really DIY about it, says Proust. I do know that I don't have to get it right the first time, but I also know that it would be really nice if I did. Her first challenge was trying to make sense of the walled garden. It felt like such a puzzle that I couldn't crack open. I couldn't envision it. But she's found an enthusiastic mentor and collaborator in Charlie Harper, head gardener at the nearby NEP Rewilding Project. Through historical research, he discovered that there had once been an orchard in the walled garden. Consequently, a magnificent pear tree then became a key focal point. A new path in cobbles and edged in flint now dissects the space and grounds the layout. This partnership is also impacting the way Proust is planting. A new studio garden around 4 meters by 8 meters, formerly a builder's dumping ground of rubble and compacted soil, has provided an opportunity to plant a NEP-style garden for resilient plants, with a range of bumps and rainwater-capturing hollows that can support a wider variety of insects, small mammal, and birds. A garden is made beautiful if it's biodiverse, adds Proust. Birds swooping and bees working. I don't think there's anything more beautiful than walking through a garden filled with butterflies. While she previously gardened on heavy clay, perfect for roses, across the site she is now faced with a triptych of different conditions from silty loam and clay to sand. She is approaching the variation as an opportunity to grow resilient plants that will thrive in dry conditions. I've never had conditions to grow bearded iris, and my God, I've tried. I think they're so stupidly beautiful. There are endless possibilities for the future, too. A hay barn will one day be transformed into a cider barn for Duane, who has his own cidery, 2 orchards, and the courtyard of stables around it, another blank canvas for another garden. For now, Proust is leaving the intense schedule and drama of wedding flowers and focusing on her seed business, supplying beautiful and productive flowers for cutting. This year, she's trialing 150 varieties of sweet peas and has just completed a trial of dainty violas. She produces 70% of the seeds she sells. The remainder are from specialists, and each packet features her own illustrations. We're curious about finding interesting plants and sharing that information and the seeds. We just love that idea of more flowers, not just here, but everywhere. An article by Claire Colson, published on February 21st in the Financial Times of London, Lessons from a Flower Farmer. Listen to what you like, then fill your life with it. We turn now to a couple of articles where people are exploring what they find wonderful. First is by Robin Lane Fox, his most recent article, published on the 19th of February in the Financial Times, The Genius and Joys of Pelargoniums. Order in bulk now and admire their floriferous charms for months on end. It pays to look ahead. Gardening exemplifies this maxim, one which brightens the wettest and darkest days of the new style British winter. Looking ahead can also save money. I have been projecting my mind forwards and working out how much I can save by acting early on what I need. Sometimes the result is a tenfold return in 4 months. Even an investment in the wilder shores of hope has next to no chance of matching these returns. The horticultural call option of the moment is to order bedding plants as plugs. Plugging has been on the rise for amateur gardens in the past 10 years. Instead of sowing packets of seeds and monitoring them daily until they germinate and grow on, we can buy pre-germinated little plants in trays or packs and skip the weeks of watching and watering. If you like to ski away in February and March, plugs will survive a week of inattention. Freshly sown seedlings need a constant eye. Here's my top tips to plug geraniums, as we call them, though correctly they are pelargoniums. Rarefied gardeners remain reticent about these lovely plants, stereotyping them as plants for municipal bedding schemes without much attraction for bees. Influencers go on about grasses, not about red geraniums, but these fine bedding plants have been beloved by the gardening public for the past 150 years. Throughout the summer, one of the loveliest uses of bedding plants is to set pots of scarlet geraniums down steps into a garden or out from a house. Gardeners in the south of France have long been adept at this style, using single-colored geraniums and nothing else. Geraniums are also superb when chosen to fall forward from window boxes. The place to see them in profusion is Córdoba in Spain, where tumbling geraniums are pinned in pots against white walls or used in window boxes on every single level of houses on the city squares. During the first fortnight in May, Córdoba hosts a thrilling Fiesta de los Patios, or Festival of Courtyards, when the year's geraniums are already at their sunny best. A battle of flowers coincides with it when tens of thousands of carnations are thrown by participants on the Paseo de la Victoria. I have yet to be invited to a battle of geraniums in, say, Woking. Córdoba's carnation fight is tremendous fun. These so-called geraniums are best grown afresh from 1 year to the next. An easy way to do so is to root cuttings in autumn from mature plants and grow them on in frost-free places until they can be bedded out in spring. Quite often, I forget to root them in time. Last autumn, I overlooked bits of the good dark crimson Lord Bute and left it to risk a frost before Christmas. Sadistic Mother Nature obliged, and it is now stone dead. New plants, not plugs, cost about £5 each. I was more careful with two excellent varieties from the either end of horticultural society. Pelargonium Mabel Gray is a vigorous mauve-flowered variety with lemon-scented leaves, named by Lady Baring after her own mother when she found it while Government House in Kenya in 1962. From a different social level, Garten Director Hermann is a small-flowered, floriferous variety, vigorous in pots where it makes a mound of purple-pink and white flowers. I have yet to identify the Hermann who directed the relevant garden, but he never rose high in diplomatic service. Neither variety is sold as plugs, so I am glad to have planned ahead and taken cuttings to carry them forward. Plugs come into their own when growing bigger flowered geraniums, plants to be used in groups as well as individual pots. By May, potted plants of them will sell for at least £4 each, making a bed of a dozen rather costly. Just now, plugs of the best of them can be booked for 50p each or less. Seed companies like Dobie's, Sutton's, and Thompson & Morgan all offer them by mail order, as do the bulb merchants J. Parker's and specialized growers such as Brookside and Staffordshire, a disciplined enterprise which has just come top in Which magazine's survey of plug plant suppliers in the UK. There are several points to absorb before entering this market. Headline prices usually exclude packing and delivery. Many plugs will not be delivered until late March, but need to be booked now before stocks run out. The bigger the quantity, the keener the price. As I write, Dobie's are offering 6 plug plants of geranium best red for £8 and 42 for £17, far the better value. Prices change frequently, but the principle remains. The more you order, the cheaper each one is. If you want a big bedding display, try Brookside's wholesale section, where 350 plants of a top white geranium cost only £65, plus packing and delivery. If you wait till May, these plants will have been potted on into sizes of up to a liter and priced at £4 each or more. The sooner the plug plants arrive, the bigger you can make them by the time they go outdoors without risk of frost. I put the tiny young plants individually into 7-centimeter pots of good compost, using biodegradable pots if I have run out of previous suppliers' plastic ones. When the roots fill that pot, I transplant them into a bigger pot at my convenience. The only time I have to be on their schedule, not mine, is when they arrive. They will usually be sent in batches inside transparent plastic packs, which have been snapped shut. They must not be left unopened for longer than a day after arrival. They are small and fragile and need to be handled with great care and patience. Dobie's plugs of Best Red will be sent by the end of February. I endorse this excellent variety's name as it flowers so long and tidily, making a patch of excellent red. The flowers are semi-double and are not of much interest to pollinators, but they attract butterflies in autumn, and in most gardens, pollinators are spoilt for choice anyway. If not, a few alternatives can be mixed in near a group of Best Red. Among the trailers, I like Trailing Sunflare Reuben Deep Red, a long-flowering variety which deserves its name and is semi-double. It falls prettily over a window box without being too leggy and brittle. Brookside is offering 5 bigger plug plants for £11 to be delivered in late March. They pair well with Evita Trailing White, a glistening variety whose flowers have a little mark of red near their centers. If you prefer a single flower, try Ivy Leaf Single Balcon White Polar. Once you enter the plug market, where do you stop? Only when you have caught up on all the plants you wished you had remembered to sow earlier, or feared that you would lack the heat necessary to start their seeds into growth. Trailing the list, I have added white bacopa, a summer essential for pots and containers, and Canterbury Bells in pink, blue, and white from J. Parker's at £22 for 10 in 7-centimeter pots delivered within a month. Plug plants allow foolish virgins to catch up with their wise sisters. Canterbury Bells also attract pollinators, balancing the sterility of long-lasting hybrid Best Red. A recent column by our good friend Robin Lane Fox, published on the 19th of February in the Financial Times of London, The Genius and Joys of Pelargoniums. We turn next to Anne Treneman, the gardening columnist for the Times of London, an article published on February 6th, Why You Can Never Have Too Many Hellebores. Sumptuous and glamorous, these colorful plants can happily fill a winter garden bed. It's very easy this time of year to become a hellebore about hellebores. And why not? If you want colorful flowers in the winter garden bed, then you'll need a hellebore or three, or indeed 30. Can you have too many hellebores? It seems not, because it's one of those plants that over the past few decades has been the focus of dedicated breeding. The result is a positive profusion of hellebores. There's no official collective noun, though some have suggested a happiness of hellebores. Sounds about right, though I would also offer up a confusion as an alternative. Every year, those for sale in garden centers seem to get more sumptuous and glamorous, at times to the point of bling, while the more traditional ones are harder to find. The hybrid revolution in hellebore land over the past 25 years has resulted in hundreds of options, but some things remain the same. There remain two basic types, the stemmy ones, also known as coalescent, such as our native stinking hellebore that can grow up to a meter tall, and the stemless, a causalescent, with leaves and flowers coming directly out of the ground. The stemless include the old-fashioned favorite Christmas rose, which is the stalwart of so many gardens, including my mother's and mine. They also include the popular garden hybrids grown from seed that were previously known as Helleborus orientalis and have now been renamed HX hybridus, though are often still called orientalis just to confuse us more. Over the past decade or so, the big, showy interspecies hybrids such as Anna's Red, many with varied leaf patterns as well, have become the garden center superstars. So, how to choose? There are a ridiculous number of options, and some, because of the effort involved in creating them, can be expensive. Flower shapes include cup, star, and flat, as well as nodding and semi-nodding. They can be single, double, or anemone-centered. Sepals, not petals, are veined, spotted, blotched, or star-centered. Colors include white, cream, peach, apricot, pinks, greens, yellows, purples, and lavenders, grays, and blacks. If you put all these together, it would be a pretty crazy family photo. Where to start? You could stay pure and grow the wild or species types. These tend to have a muted palette of greens and creams and include the Christmas rose as well as our native Helleborus foetidus, or stinking hellebore with its striking, nodding green flowers. It's the leaves that smell, but only when crushed. At the other extreme, there are those new named superstars. It took the late Rodney Davey more than 12 years to perfect Anna's Red in honor of the garden writer Anna Pavord, with its marbled leaves and striking red flowers at his Devon nursery. Other favorites include Penny's Pink and Moondance, which live up to their eye candy billing. In the middle, though distinctly not middling, are the huge number of garden hybrids. John Crimshaw, the author and botanist, who is the former director of the Yorkshire Arboretum, says that you cannot beat these in terms of staying power. His experience is that the new named showier ones don't perform for long in the ground. You just don't see them as established specimens in the ground, which tells me that they are not robust. He suggests choosing your favorites from the range of Helleborus X hybridus available from the hellebore specialist nurseries such as Ashwood and Kingswinford in the West Midland. Color and flower shape is down to personal choice. For me, the paler ones are the most useful in the garden because they show up on dingy days, which is kind of important in an English winter, he says. The blacks and dark reds are absolutely sumptuous, but they are inconspicuous when they are actually in the open ground. I like whites, pale yellows, and pale pinks because they stand out. To create your own hybrid, Grimshaw suggests using three plants of the same color and exchanging the pollen among them, gathering it from the plant's anthers and depositing it on the central stigma using a small brush or your fingers. This helps to avoid getting murky muddles. The seed capsules will then fatten up through the spring. From May onwards, they will get puffy and ready to pop. They just begin to open at the tips a bit, and you can see the white seeds inside. Then you pick it, clean the seed by gently blowing away the chaff, and sow it immediately in a small pot with some compost. This is really important. The seeds mustn't get desiccated. Leave the pots outside and pot when the first True Leaves appears. Anne's favorite hellebores include, for pots, I would go big and bold with Anna's Red. For beds, personal bests are the single and or speckled pinks from the Harvington or Ashwood ranges. For structure, the Corsican or holly-leaved Helleborus argutifolius with pale green flowers. For tradition, you cannot beat the beautiful white Helleborus niger, the Christmas rose. An article by garden columnist Anne Treneman, published on February 6th in The Times of London, Why You Could Never Have Too Many Hellebores. We turn next to a column also by Anne Treneman and published a week before Friday, January 23rd, in The Times of London. I have been suffering from gardener's block. Here's why. My garden makeover has stalled, and it has taken me some time to figure out why. I can report that the transformation has, at least, begun. As regular readers know, I moved in late 2024 from Bakewell in Derbyshire to Kent, to a much smaller garden. I forced myself, at times with what can only be called extreme willpower, to wait a year to make changes. Actually, make changes is a rather delicate way to put it, because in the end, it was a rip-out. It's a small garden, 10 by 5 meters at the front of the house, and there is no back garden. It is walled, which makes it sound like some sort of mini stately home garden, but the reality is somewhat different. The walls were a hodgepodge. If you start at the front door and travel round, they were London brick, dark brown wood shingles, light brown wooden fence, render painted black, more dark brown shingles, a garage wall that was an indeterminate gray. It was a mess, technical term. It was hard to know where to look, and wherever your eye did alight, it felt wrong. The first thing to sort out was the walls. I wasn't going to change the house, obviously, but the rest had to be unified. My crazy wall situation may sound extreme, but I go to lots of gardens that have similarly mismatched wall colors and surfaces. People just don't see it when it's their own, but I couldn't stop seeing it. I toyed briefly with a dark color. Something like dark green can look dramatic and rather sophisticated. Dark colors can make a smaller garden look bigger as the walls disappear. However, here there's a wisteria trailing along the top of the walls, and it's obvious where they are. Also, I found the black wall depressing. My antidepressant strategy was a gray-beige paint color called muted clay. When done, suddenly the garden looked unified and larger. I shouldn't be surprised by what was found when the transformation began, but oh my. When we took off the shingles from one wall, underneath was an almost illegally bright yellow. Wow, I thought, it's like living in an egg yolk. There were other surprise discoveries. The first was that the only water source was a hose that came from underneath the garage. How strange is that? A new tap was installed and the hose cut off. Another, that the lids of the meter boxes had blown off, and my duct tape solution, my answer along with WD-40 to everything, kept failing, leaving the meters open to the weather. Now I know that you can buy new covers on Amazon for £34.99 each. I found that a secret shrub behind the hazel was so close to the garage it was virtually in the wall. It was a euonymus that had been cut back for years, as the trunk was thick. Classic situation. It's easier to cut it back than to get the stump out. An axe was deployed, but I'm still not sure we got all of it. Another surprise. The entire garden used to be a playground. I discovered this via a chance comment from someone who lived nearby nearly 50 years ago. This explained why the ground was so compacted. No wonder the lawn had been so scrappy. All of that was a few months ago. I had been waiting until after the planting to write about it, but the only planting so far has been three trees, which, as they are in the playground, required some serious digging and mulching. I have moved on from mulching to praying that they survive, and somehow their roots will be able to get through the clay. I normally love the process of planting, making lists and a design and so on, but this time I kept finding excuses not to. It's been 2 months and it's getting ridiculous. Spring is coming sooner rather than later. I have never suffered from writer's block, but this seemed to be gardener's block. There is probably something else at play here, though. I love the dreaming phase of a new garden, where ideas float in and out and everything looks, in my mind, beautiful. The reality phase, finding and buying plants, sorting through the inevitable failures, etc., is much more sobering. It's a small garden. There's no room for failure. Still, it's time to get a grip. An article by Anne Treneman, published on January 23rd in the Times of London, I have been suffering from gardener's block. Here's why. We close this week with some practical advice from garden columnist Joe Swift, an article published on February 20th in the Times of London, How to Rescue a Garden from Winter Neglect. Joe Swift has a plan to get a damaged or waterlogged plot back in shape and for protecting it in the future. Earlier this year, we had two named storms, Goretti and Chandra, with severe winds and flooding in many areas. Gardens suffered as a result, with trees down, branches broken, and areas underwater for many weeks. Plants and gardens are surprisingly resilient, and given time, most will fully recover. The weather, plus a lack of enthusiasm for getting out and gardening in a muddy mess, which, when trodden on, exacerbates the issue, will have left many spaces neglected this winter. I have tried to keep off the wettest area in my garden, and have thinned out some small trees, reducing the canopy so that strong winds can pass through, putting them in a better position to cope. Here is an action plan to get a neglected or damaged space back in shape and things to consider going forward. Try these drainage solutions. Some areas will have been saturated all winter, with surface water evident in the wettest periods. Hardy plants that have been growing here for years are likely to recover when things dry up. That's down to a combination of plants coming into growth and soaking up the water, as well as drying winds and temperatures generally rising. Surface water usually sits at the lowest point of the garden, where the soil is heavy, on the edges of paved areas or under shed roofs, where the combined runoff has nowhere to go. It's worth noting that these areas take some photographs and considering improving drainage when it is dry. That may sound like a lot to do, but it is a simple solution and has worked miracles in my garden, especially around the house. Dig a trench and lay a perforated pipe. They come in a range of sizes from 60 to 100 millimeters in diameter, in gravel to draw the water away from the wettest areas. At the lowest point, you will need a soakaway, a big hole backfilled with hardcore or plastic crates, where the water collects and permeates the surrounding soil. Otherwise, make a rain garden, which is like a pond, but it is wet in winter and drier in summer, and direct the water to it. The rain garden can be planted up with species that can cope with both extremes, such as Iris pseudocorus, Iris sibirica, Juncus effusius, Xanthadecia aethiopica, Persicaria, Verbena bonarensis, hardy geraniums, hosta, and Crocosmia. Some people divert their downpipes into these rain gardens, which makes a great feature and can be an excellent habitat for wildlife. Keep off wet areas to avoid compacting the soil. The best way to do is to keep off any wet areas, as any weight on the soil will lead to compaction further down the line, potentially making drainage even worse. If you must get across these particularly wet areas for access, to prune broken branches, for instance, try to spread your weight on boards or perhaps invest in some rubber mats, some of which have holes in, to avoid compacting the already wet soil. Shrubs such as dogwood, black elder, some hydrangeas, and Rosa rugosa, as well as some of the aforementioned perennials, will all do well in these areas. Check newly planted shrubs for wind rock. Wind rock is often a problem for newly planted species, usually woody plants such as trees and shrubs. The plant becomes unstable at the base and air gaps are formed, so some roots may not be in contact with the soil and dry out. It can be terminal. It is worth checking anything you have planted in the past couple of years, even if it is upright. Firm the soil back in around the roots. With larger ones, use your heel and stake these plants low down to avoid further movement until they are established once again. Check out any plants that have been blown over. If they have snapped at the base, prune back hard with a clean cut in the hope they will rejuvenate. If they have blown over with trunk, stems, and root ball intact, then replant and stake. They should be fine. Cut any damaged branches cleanly. Dangling branches on large and medium trees can be dangerous, especially if you walk or sit under them. And for the health of the plant, open wounds can lead to infection. It is usually best to tidy them up. Where there are broken branches, make a clean cut below that point using a sharp pruning saw. Once the damaged branch has been dealt with, you may want to prune out more to balance the shape of the plant. Always cut to a junction if possible, rather than leaving pegs. Any medium or large trees will require a qualified tree surgeon. Check for the TPO, tree preservation orders, on specific trees, and determine whether you are in a conservation area before you start, as you will need written permission. Use broken containers as a chance to repot plants. I have a few terracotta pots that have blown over and broken. This is a good time for repotting many garden plants up a size, which provides an opportunity to refresh the compost. Place them in a protected spot, use some sandbags, or fix to a wall until the threat of strong winds has passed. Has a climber come away from the wall? It may need a hard prune. Climbers coming off walls is a common scenario, as a trellis can act like a sail in the wind. With non-self-clinging climbers that need support, such as roses, wisteria, or jasmine, it is likely your support will need remaking. If the plant is mature and you can lay it away from the vertical while doing this, great. If not, you will probably have to cut it back. Fear not. Most climbers like a hard prune every now and then, although with spring flowering plants, you will lose some blooms this year. Tie them back into the new support. Self-clinging climbers, such as Virginia creeper, climbing hydrangeas, or ivy, that have come away from the wall or fence, cannot just be stuck back up again. Some can be pruned a little. Then you could make a support with wires or trellis and tie the plant back in the hopes it grips again. But the whole point of these self-clinging plants is that they avoid having to do this. It's the new growth that grips best, so often it's wise to cut your climber back quite hard to encourage this so it can start over again. An article by Joe Swift, published in the Times of London on February 20th, How to Rescue a Garden from Winter Neglect. And that wraps up edition 332 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program produced for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send us your comments at www.larrs.org or email us at one word, laradioreading@gmail.com. Gardens are not just plants, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us, even as we try to create order and impose structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty, of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardens, other gardeners, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky, gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.